This lecture is going to be a general introduction to the Gospel of John. We are not going to pursue a particular theme or question, but offer an overview of some material that is generally helpful as you read. Some of this material has come out in one part or another of our conversations, but the whole picture has not been set out at any point in our conversations so far. I'm going to talk about the author. I'm going to talk about the date and historical situation of the gospel, and I'm going to talk about the structure of the gospel. Regarding the author, of course, we know that the author is the Apostle John. This is not something directly explicitly said in the text. Instead, he refers to himself as the disciple whom Jesus loved, or the beloved disciple, and speaks of himself in the third person throughout the gospel, and only at the end do we find out that this beloved disciple is the witness referred to in the gospel, the one who has witnessed to these things. Now, he calls himself the beloved disciple, I think, for a good reason, a couple of good reasons. One reason is that by giving himself simply a title, like the disciple whom Jesus loved, he's able to open the door to having the reader step into his role in the gospel, to have the reader be the one who's witnessing these events, be the one who is present at this or that scene. We have a parallel to this, possibly, in the Gospel of Luke, who addresses his gospel to Theophilus. Now, Theophilus may well have been just a rich man who bankrolled the project of writing Luke's gospel, but since the name means a lover of God, it certainly opens the door for anyone who loves God to see this gospel as directed to him. Similarly, the Gospel of John has the central figure, or the witness, be the one whom Jesus loved, which could be a description of any disciple. Hopefully as a description of you or me. But more particularly, there are scenes where I think John would like us to step in and be in his place. For example, by the cross, when Jesus says to Mary, "Woman, behold your son," and then to the beloved disciple, "Behold your mother," I think all of us are supposed to see ourselves in that scene, receiving Mary as our mother, and then taking her, so to speak, into our homes. There's another reason, I think, that John gives himself a symbolic title, and that is the beloved disciple is presented as a kind of contrast or counterpart to Peter the apostle. Again and again, they are put next to each other, and the beloved disciple comes out a little bit ahead. So when the when they're at the Last Supper, Peter's the guy who wants to know who is Jesus talking about, but it's the beloved disciple who's actually leaning on the breast of Jesus and can ask him the question. Later on, when they come to the courtyard of the house where Jesus is being tried, the beloved disciple goes right in because he knows people, and Peter's caught up at the gate. And the beloved disciple has to come back and open the gate to let Peter in, right? So the beloved disciple is the one who has the necessary connections. Or again, towards the end of the story, after the resurrection, when they're told that Jesus is risen, Peter and the beloved disciple run to the tomb, and the beloved disciple outruns Peter. He gets there first, but then he just sort of peeks in. He doesn't go in. He stands aside in deference to Peter and lets Peter go in to be the first one actually to enter the tomb of the risen Christ. Again, at the very end of the story, when the disciples are out fishing and Jesus calls to them from the shore and gives them instructions on how to fish, eventually it's the beloved disciple who turns and recognizes who it is and says, "It is the Lord." Right? He's the one who gets it first, but then it's Peter who, in excitement, jumps over the edge of the boat and swims to shore. Again, at the very, very end of the gospel, we have the contrast between Peter being told, essentially, that he is going to die a martyr's death, and then he wants to know about the beloved disciple. And Jesus has that enigmatic saying, ah, what's this to you? What if I want him to live forever? So they're put next to each other again and again, and the pattern is fairly consistent. The beloved disciple is a little ahead or a little better, a little more insightful, but Peter is the head of the apostles, the head of the church. And there's a great lesson there, right? That is, the successor of Peter, the Pope, is not supposed to be someone who's a brilliant theologian and is leading the way for us. Innovative theology is not the job of the successor of Peter. It's going to be your Carmelite mystic or your devout layperson or your monk in an obscure monastery who's going to have the new trailblazing insight. And then it will be the successor of Peter who later on says yes or no to that insight. It's going to be others who lead the way. It's going to be the successor of Peter who is in charge, who's providing stability. It's the difference, we shouldn't assume that being exalted to the chair of Peter means you must have been the best guy around. John seemed to be saying, no, not really. It just means Jesus put you in charge, and that's enough. I think that's a great lesson for our time, something we could all afford to think about. John did not live forever. However, he did live a long time. He is the one of the 12 apostles who did not suffer a martyr's death before old age. So, of course, Peter was killed around in the 60s A.D. James was actually of the Peter, James, John trio. James was actually the first of the apostles to be martyred, already recorded within the book of Acts. And so on and so forth. One by one, they all suffered a martyr's death. There are legends about attempts on John's life, like throwing him into a pot of boiling oil and he just jumps out and he's fine. Hard to verify these legends, but suffice to say, tradition bears out the idea that John lived actually to old age and did not, in the end, die as a martyr, although he did eventually die. And that is important for his gospel, because John's gospel is written when John is an old man. Tradition and modern scholarship agree that John's gospel is the latest of the gospels and much later than the others, probably written in the 90s, pushing up towards 100 AD. At a point where John is no longer young. He was very young when he met Jesus. But now he's an old man, and he's seen a lot, and had his whole life to just meditate on what happened with Jesus, what happened during those years of Jesus' public ministry. And so while a gospel like Mark has this kind of rough and raw feel to it of, where you feel like you're almost there. It's like breaking news. John's gospel is very meditative, long speeches, not constant action. It's a gospel written by a guy who has been thinking for many decades, thinking for a lifetime about this. And he's bringing all the fruit of his meditation into his account. Now, it's important for other reasons as well that John is writing late. That is, it changes the situation. Early in the life of the church, the Christians were seen and even to some extent saw themselves as a variant of Jew. So we see in the Acts of the Apostles, Paul goes into the temple to do the rituals to complete the vow he had taken. We see Paul still going into synagogues. It's only over the course of the gospel of the book of Acts that we see Paul beginning to direct his ministry more exclusively to the Gentiles as the Jews are rejecting his message. But it's still normal, even at the book end of the book, for Christians to go into a synagogue or into the temple, and that's the way they appeared to the Roman authorities as some kind of Jewish sect. And that's the way they appeared really to Jews as well, that Jews would regard them as either some new form of Judaism or perhaps as a Jewish heresy. But the idea that the Christians were just something new, a new religion, was not as clear for the very earliest days of Christianity. But as time went on, and the distinctiveness of the Christian faith became really clear, and more opportunities for this or that hostility came up, the Jews themselves eventually realized, this is not us, and they eventually officially expelled Christians and Christianity from the synagogue. And there was hostility between the groups, with including some attempts by Jews to have Christians persecuted by the authorities. So by the time you get to John's writing, Christians have lost their sense of sort of being a Jewish breakoff, and have become clear in their minds that the Jews are just a different group. It's not themselves. So this is why in John's gospel, unlike any of the others, the opponents of Jesus are referred to as the Jews. Right? So in Mark's gospel or in Matthew's gospel, the opponents will be the Pharisees or the Sadducees, right? And then but not just the Jews, because everybody's Jewish in this story. And really, historically, everybody's Jewish in the Gospel of John as well. But John is writing for a group who see their contemporary opponents as this other group called the Jews who are persecuting them. And he brings out the parallels between how the Jews are persecuting them and how the opponents of Jesus persecuted Jesus. And so we get these references to the Jews throughout. Not that the Gospel of John is meant to be anti-Semitic or deny that Jesus himself was a Jew. Another important thing about the time of John's gospel is another set of opponents. Besides the Jews persecuting them from the outside, when we discover when we read John's letters for 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, that there were also problems on the inside within Christianity. There was an early budding heresy that seemed to have said something like Jesus did not have a real body, but was only became man in appearance, so that the God sort of created a hologram to walk around for several years, but didn't really become flesh and blood, and John counters this point strongly at various moments in his gospel. Right out from the beginning, with his shocking phrase that the Word became flesh, right? He really emphasizes that the Word became not just a man, right? But he picks that word flesh and just drives it home. This is behind, I also think, to some extent, the scene where the blood and the water come out of Jesus' side at the crucifixion. It's emphasizing the real flesh and bloodiness of Jesus, that this was a man where if you stabbed him in the side, actual bodily fluids came out. So he's always opposing this heresy that has arisen within the Christian community. Now, another thing that's going on with the late date of John's gospel, final point about the dating, is that being long after the other gospels and so on, John can, in a way, play with some of the traditions. I don't mean that in a playful way, but I mean he can take advantage of the fact that the people he's talking to know the story of Jesus. Mark is it seems like a kind of first proclamation of the good news, right? I mean, now the community for which Mark was written would be a Christian community, so they also know the story. But what Mark is trying to capture was, remember when Peter proclaimed the word to us? Can we capture what he said so we can just go back and hear that original proclamation again and again? John is not offering us a first gospel. He's very consciously offering us a late gospel. And so, knowing full well various of the traditions regarding Jesus or various of the stories regarding Jesus, he doesn't always give them to us. We talked about this some in class. So, for example, John's not going to give us the Transfiguration, even though it occurs in the other Gospels, even though it's a well-known event, because John wants us to be waiting for that. He wants us to be waiting for Jesus's big moment of glory when he's going to be just shine, and he denies us that moment in order to put it on the cross, so that the hour of glory is the cross, and that causes us to ask a lot of hard questions. How is the cross the very glory of Jesus? Right, and think about it, these internal opponents he has within Christianity. The people who don't think Jesus was really had a body also don't think he really died. That wouldn't be possible. So it couldn't be that the crucifixion is the hour of Jesus' glory for them. John is just going to rub it in their faces. Oh, yes, it is. So he's not going to give us the Transfiguration. He's withholding it to for an effect. There's another example of this, I think, where John gives us in chapter 6 the absolutely clearest statements we find anywhere in the New Testament about the Eucharist. These statements about the Eucharist, about the necessity of eating Jesus' body and blood, are put in a context that's full of Passover references. It was the time of Passover. It's in the context of the multiplication of the loaves, and so on. So he's strongly associating the Eucharist with the Passover, indicating that he's fully aware of the version of the story that's out there. That we would find, say, in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, where Jesus' Last Supper is a Passover meal, and during the Passover meal, he institutes the Eucharist. John knows this, but he reconstructs his chronology to such that, we get to the Last Supper, and it's not the Passover yet. And we're thinking as Christians, isn't this the Last Supper? Isn't the Eucharist supposed to happen now? What's going on? And you're confused, and you're wondering, wait a minute, back in chapter 6, you set me up, right? Didn't you set me up for Eucharist at Passover? Where is it? Well, but John has reshuffled his chronology to land the hour of Jesus' death at the exact hour when the Passover lambs would be sacrificed. He wants us to see Jesus on the cross and see the Passover lamb. And then, if in case you missed it, he reinforces that at the point where the soldiers don't break the bones of Jesus. They break the legs of those crucified on either side of him. But when they come to Jesus and he's already dead, they don't break his legs. And John says this was to fulfill what the scripture says, not a bone of his shall be broken. Well, that is a quotation from the regulations in Exodus regarding the Passover lamb. He's pointing Jesus, there's your Passover lamb. There is your Eucharist, right? So, ironically, the reason that John doesn't give us the Eucharist at the Last Supper is the same as the reason that he has the most shocking statements about the necessity of eating Jesus' flesh and blood. It's because he wants to pound home that in the Eucharist, you are receiving a real body. This was not a hologram. This was not just an appearance. This is the flesh and blood of Jesus really in the Eucharist. And so he's going to wait for that moment when you expected the Eucharist and have it lined up with the actual crucified body of Jesus. Okay, so enough about the author and historical setting. Let's look at the structure. Take a look at the outline that I gave you on the handout last class. Let me call your attention to some salient features. First off, at least as I see the Gospel of John, we have a chiasmus here. Now, a chiasmus is a structure where you go up to a certain point and then you mirror it, like an A, B, C, D, C, B, A pattern here. Where A and A are parallel and B are parallel, C and C are parallel, right? In a good chiasmus, the center point is a kind of turning point moment that just in one way or another explains the differences between the parallel members. And the parallel members are sections where we're invited to compare and contrast. Why I think this is a chiasmus will, in the Gospel of John, will become clear as we go through. To get an initial grip on the structure of the Gospel of John, I was looking for clues that John would give us, right? I'm not just reading the Gospel and deciding how many parts I think it has. I'm trying to figure out, does he have any indicators where he shows me how many parts he thinks it has? Or to put it another way, does he try to show me where one section ends and another section begins? Because if I can find the breaks between sections, then I can go back and count how many there are. There are some fairly reasonable things we could look to. In the Gospel of John, there are Jesus travels from place to place. He takes journeys, and you can have a journey begin and end, and then have another journey. So, place might be a clue. If one scene takes place over here and another scene over there, that could be a division. Another sort of common sense way that he could divide his story would be with time. So if one thing happens one year and then another thing another year or another month or another week, that could be an indicator. So if we have a story where things are happening in a certain sequence where you sort of know this is in a definite time relation to the thing before it, and then suddenly you flash to something where it was just at a different time and you don't know what time it is now, well, there's an obvious break. So you putting together place and time, what you find is they more or less give you the same sections, not surprisingly. That if you just take place or time as your dividing point, you get these seven sections of the Gospel of John. Now, admittedly, the last section is much bigger than all the rest. That's typical for the Gospels, that the Passion story is a coherent member with that's very big compared to the rest, because Gospel stories are kind of Passion stories with an introduction. But once you get to the Passion story, the time and place are very continuous. We don't hit breaks, really. We could argue for internal structure of the last big section, but it seems to hold together as one big section. So we get one big section at the end and six smaller sections before it. And then, tidily enough, those line up to where you have one sign per section. So again, if you just take common sense dividers like place and time, it breaks into seven parts, and lo and behold, each part gets one of the seven signs. The big sign, of course, being the Paschal Mystery at the end. That's a fairly convincing case to me already, but let's look at some of the details to see how well this works as explaining what's going on in the Gospel of John. Well, the first section is defined by these the 7 days. I th think on your Gospel of John posters it may be labeled as 6 days, but here's how it works. You get an opening scene, which presumably is day one. Then you get a scene described as the next day, so it's continuous in time. We know where we are, and then the next day, and then the next day. So far we've had 4 days, and then the wedding at Cana is described as having taken place on the third day. Now, how are we counting those three? Does the counting 1, 2, 3 include the fourth day as the first of those 3 days, or are we supposed to go from four and then count 5, 6, 7? I think the latter is more convincing. That's why I've gone with day seven. That would have a kind of new creation motif going on at the wedding at Cana. There's another reason that I think this is interesting or convincing. If you look at the last section, the Passion story, we have the Passion itself taking place on a seventh day. So the John is described as coming to Bethania or to Bethany 6 days before the Passover. And then, of course, in John's Gospel, the Passover is going to be the day on which he dies. You could say, are those 6 days including the Passover? And you could have a similar question, I suppose. But it appears to me that we have a seventh day going on with the Passover itself, which would line up with the seventh day in the first section. Moreover, if this parallel between A and A is going to work out, it would fit with the fact that there are seven sections, so that your last section is the seventh, and the key moment takes place on a seventh day, paralleling the first section with its 7 days. Are we supposed to see these two signs, the Paschal Mystery and the wedding in Cana, in parallel? Yeah, I think we are, because the wedding at Cana is where we encounter the mother of Jesus. And when she makes a request to Jesus, he says, "My hour has not yet come." Then we don't see Mary again until she's at the foot of the cross. And there, again, he addresses her as woman, right? That sort of a symbolic title, like the beloved disciple is a symbolic name. So woman is a symbolic name given to Mary. She's not just, you know, someone by a specific name. She's in an archetypal role. And this is the point where his hour has come, right? So there are these ties between the two scenes. And it's very suggestive that as we roll into the Passion of Jesus, where he's going to give his life for us, described as the greatest possible act of love, that we're looking at a marriage scene there at the cross. And I think I think the church fathers are really onto something when they see the opening of the side of Christ and the blood of water coming forth as both connected to the water and wine at the wedding of Cana and to Eve coming forth from the side of Christ, the church being born from Christ. And the naming of Mary as woman suggests that that we have a new Eve here, parallel to the church. So a lot going on, a lot that would connect the first and the last sections, wedding at Cana, to the crucifixion of Christ. With the second section, section B, we have the first Passover. And this is another thing that's helpful about this division, is that we end up having one major Jewish holiday associated with each of the sections except the first. So here we have the first Passover, and we have that Jesus responds to a request when someone is dying, and that was parallel to what I have labeled as B prime, the second to last section, where Jesus responds to a request when someone is dying, although in that case he waits till he does die. And here in section B, in chapters 2 through 4, notice that we also have a kind of chiastic structure within there. John gives us a leading hint when he indicates that the wedding at Cana was the first of Jesus' signs, and then that the healing of the official son was the second of Jesus' signs. So we're supposed to, and he says the second sign at Cana, right? So we're supposed to see them at parallel, in parallel. And then the other sections work out as well. Jesus, in the center, we have the witness of John that John has to decrease and Jesus must increase. But we get Nicodemus in sections B and B of this little mini chiasmus. Nicodemus, the Jew who has trouble believing, is contrasted with the Samaritan who believes right away. Nicodemus, befuddled by the discussion of the spirit that blows where it will, the need to be born again. The woman, excited by the talk of the water that will spring up within her to eternal life. So we've get this consideration of Jewish and Gentile, or Jewish and at least heretical Jewish. The Samaritan would be sort of weird, syncretistic, heretical Jewish. We get this contrast where the guy that should have got it doesn't, and the gal who shouldn't have got it does. So that's what's going on in that little chiasmus there. Then we move to section C, Sections C and C prime are these two times when Jesus is seen by the Jews as violating the Sabbath. He heals a kind of traditional pair, the lame and the blind, in those two. We have the section C occurs on an unnamed feast. It says it was a feast of the Jews. Well, it's probably that means the Sabbath in this case. So that's and that becomes the center of the controversy. And that leaves us with the middle section, section D, the multiplication of the loaves and fish. This is the this is of all the signs, the sign that is most clearly tied to the passion of Jesus. This is the one about Jesus's flesh and blood and the necessity of eating it. The this is the, I mean, it's not that the whole section is about the Eucharist. There is also the necessity of eating Jesus spiritually through belief in him. But it does lead in the end to the scandalous claim that there's something about his very flesh and blood. This is apparently a claim that is contentious in John's actual historical church when he's writing the gospel because of these people who don't think that Jesus had flesh and blood. And so there's a parallel between the Jews who find this a hard saying, boy, this would, seems like, sounds like it'd be cannibalism, and the deviant Christians in John's midst, in his church, in his time, who aren't going to participate in Eucharistic worship because they find this, for other reasons, a hard saying. And this is the scene where Peter himself, you know, is asked by Jesus, do you want to leave? Right? It's this important. But also, this is the scene where, for the first time, John mentions that Judas was going to betray Jesus. Jesus says, you know, when Peter gives his wonderful response, well, Lord, to whom would you go? You have the words of eternal life. Jesus says, you know, basically, I know which ones of you are faithful. I know what's going on. And John comments this, he said this because he knew about Judas, the one who was going to betray him. Not, you know, we don't really have an account of Judas. We don't know what all, nobody's ever written the apostolic biography of Judas. There's the suggestion here that this time when so many walked away from Jesus and the disciples hung on just by faith, that maybe this planted the seed of Judas's betrayal. And do we know that? I don't know. I'm not sure how confident we should be of that. But certainly, the suggestion of the betrayal of Jesus is introduced together with this hard saying about the flesh and blood of Jesus. And so, if this is a good way to read the scene, then that would make this the turning point in the chiasmus. That would explain the difference between the early time and the later time, the difference between, say, the wedding at Cana when Jesus shows his glory and the disciples believe and it's this beautiful wedding scene, and the parallel at where you'd think this is supposed to be, this is a wedding, but it's a very different kind of wedding, a wedding with Jesus dying, having been betrayed by Jesus. And as I've argued before, we're supposed to see that passion scene, that wedding scene, as Eucharistic, right? As we would call it in the Mass, the wedding supper of the Lamb. So that would be, I think, why section D is the center of the chiasmus. There you have a basic intro to who was John. What was the historical situation of his writing, and why is that important? And the structure of the Gospel of John. I would encourage you to keep the handout ready the next time you read the Gospel of John. And before you need to do that, I will be sending out instructions for what to highlight.